Hello and welcome back to another episode here of the Damage Report. After day two of the DNC and entering into a very weird day of news indeed. This might have to be Weird News Wednesday as opposed to Big News Wednesdays. But that's the only change. The constant is J.R. Jackson. How's it going, J.R.?
Hey, news is news, bro. Hey, big news, weird news, weird big news. I'm down. Let's do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're gonna do a little bit from the DNC last night. We've got updates on the post office, maybe moving in the right direction, who knows? We're gonna drill, baby, drill. We've got an interesting, so I've got a poll, but I know what you're probably thinking. Oh, a poll, we've had polls before. This is different. This is a different type of poll.
Sure.
Maybe it'd be a little bit interesting. We'll see. We've got Trump on his brother who recently passed away. We're gonna take a look at what sort of person Trump is as he experiences this grief that obviously we feel bad for him for. And then at the end of the show, you're not gonna wanna miss it because you remember last week when Ben Shapiro made an absolute fool out of himself over that Cardi B song? Tucker Carlson looked down on that and thought, not alone you won't. And so he's weighed in on it now too. So we'll have that for you. And a few little news tidbits sprinkled in, little things that we don't have a ton of time to comment on, like the fact that Laura Loomer won a congressional primary. What is going on in America? She's a legitimate crazy person.
Well, I mean, she's openly a legitimate crazy person. There's plenty of crazy people that are in Congress. They just hide it well. There's a crazy person in the White House. He doesn't hide it well. That's where we've opened up things like this.
I mean, it's she's a grifter. She is just like the Democratic Party obviously is very frustrated with like online lefties trying to pressure them and stuff like that. But like, do they get that we're trying to pressure them to change their policy positions? The right is being successfully pressured to all just become trolls on the internet. Like there's less and less of a gap between the insane QAnon supporting trolls on the internet and their literal elected officials. Like it's Congress, you know, it's a congressional primary today in November, at least one is gonna make it into Congress. Could it be a senator in 2 years or 4 years? Like how long will any Republicans last if they don't accept Q or whatever comes after Q? R, I don't know. I don't know what the next conspiracy theory is, but it's gonna be crazier. Because like with so much, we haven't talked about this in a while, but one of the things most frustrates me about everything online is that everything online is drugs. Everything hits you and it's exciting and then you start to get used to it and you need a more pure, refined, powerful version of it. And that leads to grifters in media and grifters in politics and also in conspiracy theories. Alex Jones isn't just kind of irrelevant now because of all of the obvious issues that we've talked about, but because he's been doing his shtick for so long, like people get used to it and they need something more powerful.
And conservatism is a hell of a drug, is what you're saying?
Yeah, everything. And no, literally everything. Like we get criticized sometimes by people like, why aren't you saying this? I'm like, because I'm not doing everything I can just to maintain you as an audience member of me. Like, I'm not gonna lie to you just so that you, yeah, I understand there's people crazy say crazy things so that you'll give them Patreon dollars. That's not what everybody does, okay? Last night at the DNC, we finally got AOC for a little bit. Here's what she said.
Good evening, bienvenidos, and thank you to everyone here today endeavoring towards a better, more just future for our country and our world. In fidelity and gratitude to a mass people's movement working to establish 21st century social, economic, and human rights, including guaranteed healthcare, higher education, living wages, and labor rights for all people in the United States. A movement striving to recognize and repair the wounds of racial injustice, colonization, misogyny, and homophobia, and to propose and build reimagined systems of immigration and foreign policy that turn away from the violence and xenophobia of our past. A movement that realizes the unsustainable brutality of an economy that rewards explosive inequalities of wealth for the few at the expense of long-term stability for the many, and who organized a historic grassroots campaign to reclaim our democracy. In a time when millions of people in the United States are looking for deep, systemic solutions to our crises of mass evictions, unemployment, and lack of health care, in el espíritu del pueblo and out of a love for all people, I hereby second the nomination of Senator Bernard Sanders of Vermont for President of the United States of America.
And if I can give you a live shot of many people seeing that, it was, what? She's endorsing Bernie? But that's what it was supposed to be. It's not, oh my God, she's going rogue at the last second, take her out. No. Yeah, this is what she was supposed to do. It's a formal thing. It happens at literally every Democratic convention and Republican convention.
It's just, which, by the way, if you're watching that and you're like, I'm gonna get the 60 seconds of AOC that is gonna happen tonight at the convention, you're sitting at home in Washington and you're like, oh, let me just watch it. And you're just some watcher of maybe the first time paying attention to a DNC because of the importance of this year. And you hear that and you go, oh man, she's endorsing Bernie Sanders. Oh my God, on the floor. I remember hearing about things like this happening before when like Ted Cruz didn't formally say he loves Trump at last, you know, the last cycle, all that stuff. I get that surprise. I understand having that surprise, honestly.
So I get that surprise. And I'm assuming Bernie must have suggested he wanted her to speak. And I wonder, first of all, on the good side, she got more than 60 seconds. That was like a minute 30 or something like that. On the bad side, would she have spoken if Bernie hadn't chosen her to do his seconding? I don't know. And on the third side, did they allow it because they thought that they could spin it into a way that would hurt her? This is all speculation, probably. Ooh, it's Q stuff.
No, this is R stuff, John. This is R not.
This is R. Yeah, Q, lame. Really, seriously, you still get off on Q? No, R. Are we going to believe that they didn't present that in kind of a way meant?
What? Be careful, you're formulating this group a little too well. You're gonna get a following.
Are you gonna sit there while they lie to your face? Anyway, no, but R is supposed to be anonymous. So I'm just gonna do it like this. Are you gonna accept what they say? And that would fool so many people online. Anyway, so to this, many people watching this will come away thinking that she's not supporting Biden, which of course is what she's doing. And this is a tradition formality type thing. And the issue is that while we can speculate about the DNC and whether this was sort of their plan or whatever, and that's just speculation. NBC News, on the other hand, has a little bit more to answer for. So we're gonna turn to that in 1 second. But first, because some people were confused initially, this is like right off the bat after she spoke, AOC tweeted in response to one of those tweets saying, if you were confused, no worries. Convention rules require roll call and nominations for every candidate that passes the delegate threshold, which he did. I was asked to second the nomination for Senator Sanders for roll call. I extend my deepest congratulations to Joe Biden. Let's go win in November, leaving no ambiguity as to who she's supporting in this election. And that was then turned into by NBC News. In one of the shortest speeches of the DNC, Representative Ocasio-Cortez did not endorse Joe Biden. Quote, I hereby second the nomination of Senator Bernard Sanders of Vermont for President of the United States of America. Which, let's just pause for a second. How deeply, fundamentally dishonest of a take is that for what just happened? Not some rando. NBC News, which has covered several conventions in the past, knows that this happens at every convention, knew what the content of her speech was before she gave it. They come out of that speech saying, oh, she didn't even endorse him. Wait, and she wants Bernie to be president. How fundamentally dishonest is that?
And I'm sorry, but also the minds, at least the way it was pitched, was that she had this short speech as if she came in and just wanted to speak and say really quickly how much she supports Bernie Sanders and F everybody else at this place. I don't know, if you come into it already a little bit against her, your assumptions about her can be just, or it's a launching point from that tweet and that misleading headline from NBC News, right? Also, by the way, there's many things as far as an establishment Democrat, and you don't want anything to have to do with AOC, there's plenty of things that you can criticize from that minute and 25 seconds that she had there. You can criticize the fact that she said no more colonization. You can criticize that she spoke in Spanish for a phrase or two a couple of times. You can criticize the fact that she wants things to happen for the country that's actually liberal and progressive and aren't on the normal platform and agenda for people like Joe Biden. There's plenty of things for NBC News to say that they were outraged and clutched their pearls over from her minute and 25 seconds, but they chose to go here because that would encompass enough Democrats to be against her. If you actually talk about the things that she did that you disagree with as an organization that are actually progressive, people might start going, well, that sounds good.
Yeah.
Oh, well, that might work out for me. I mean, you know, AOC might not be crazy. I haven't really listened to much anything else except for what people are saying that she said rather than what she said.
Yeah, and it, like, NBC is like, we can speculate about the DNC, and you know, I obviously am frustrated with them giving her so little time and all that. But with NBC, no, that's designed to make people believe that, oh, look, she's one of those crazies, she's turning against Joe Biden or whatever, when she's 100% not doing that. And the content of her speech, like, the right presents her as some crazy radical. That was the most reasonable, level-headed, empathic, understanding 85 seconds I've ever heard in politics. How can you listen to that and think, oh yeah, no, she's the left's Laura Loomer? How could you think that? She's talking about healthcare and wages. That's it. That's it. So reasonable. Everybody should be talking about that. Everybody should be aspiring to be able to give a concise 90 seconds like that. But anyway, NBC News sent out that tweet, and they eventually did take down the tweet. Hours later, I think it was 1:30 a.m. Eastern time, when many of the sort of people who watch a convention would probably be asleep anyway. And so she responded to that saying, you waited several hours to correct your obvious and blatantly misleading tweet. It sparked an enormous amount of hatred and vitriol. And now the misinfo you created is circulating on other networks because it is all over the place. All to generate hate clicks from a pre-recorded routine procedural motion. That's what they did. And she goes on to say, this is completely unacceptable, disappointing, and appalling. The DNC shared the procedural purpose of my remarks to media well in advance. NBC knew what was going to happen and that it was routine. How does a headline that malicious and misleading happen without that prior knowledge, or with that prior knowledge? So NBC News, how are you gonna fix the incredible amount of damage and misinformation that you are now responsible for? Because a 1:15 a.m. tweet to slip under the radar after blowing up a totally false and divisive narrative across networks isn't it. And I will respond for them, because they probably won't. They're gonna do nothing, AOC. They're gonna do absolutely nothing, because they like what they did. They do. You know, sometimes I'm gonna get some of these mixed up between CNN and MSNBC, but like, you think like the network that's okay with like talking about, you know, digital brown shirts and Bernie's like the Nazi invasion across the Maginot line is like, oh yeah, no, they're not gonna try to hurt AOC. She's so popular, they're not gonna try to hurt her. No, they're trying to take you out because they don't want, they're not gonna wait 4 years to try to take you out when you're running for president. They want to poison as many people against you as possible now and tomorrow and next week and every single day.
Yeah, well, you know, journalists in general know the power that they have over the people that they cover. And generally this happens because I, you know, grew up watching and continue to watch sports so closely that I get frustrated by sometimes the way that, even when it comes to things like voting people into Hall of Fame and things like that, journalists have a say, or even just in normal coverage of them as they do their job. It's very similar here when it comes to media outlets and knowing how they can portray a political figure any way that they want to, and there's enough people that trust what they said because the media is supposed to be trusted as the source. I mean, especially now, people will think, you know, NBC News, that's more trusted than things like Fox and OAN and all those things, right? So NBC News has something trustworthy to say. They're generally on the right side because they're supporting the guy that I like, all that. And then so this is an easy, it's a layup for them as far as getting a chance to portray her differently.
Yeah, 100%. It's so see-through. And you know what? NBC started it and they took down the tweet. So they're gonna consider themselves to be clean on this. And now people are running with it, with Fox's Kilmeade bizarrely claiming AOC leading far left Dem takeover with hostage video endorsing Bernie over Biden. The funny thing about that, if anything in politics is really funny anymore, is that they ran that like 6 hours after NBC took down the tweet. Like, there isn't a person in this country who pays attention to politics who doesn't understand every bit of what happened by the time they decided, no, it's a far left takeover, she tried to make Bernie the candidate. Wait, but I thought that they already controlled Biden. Don't they already have him in their pocket? Like, why would they then try to get Bernie? They don't need Bernie. Biden's the radical. Yeah. None of it makes any sense.
None of it ever makes any sense.
Any sense.
Yeah, it's like they were set to do that and they're like, oh, well, things changed. Well, at least NBC admitted what they said. Okay, who cares? We have something else to do. We have an entire agenda that we're set to go forward with. So who cares if reality came to light? That's not what we do here. This is Fox and Friends.
Yeah. Ugh. Yeah. Ugh, that's what I have to say. Really fast on the rest of the DNC last night. So I was talking to my friend for his birthday on the phone for like an hour, so I didn't watch most of it, honestly. I saw little bits. I hear that some people liked Jill Biden's speech. I thought that the like 17 young state legislators and mayors and stuff like that was like perfectly fine. I don't know, JR, did you watch more of the speeches last night?
You know, I have the last 2 days I've watched none of it. I plan on finally start watching it tonight. It was been a toss up in the house, so I'm in here solo now, and I hadn't been for a long time. So I'm resetting my gears, making sure that I'm ready to get into some political speak tonight. So I missed everything. I only watched Michelle Obama's later because of how much everyone was talking about it. So I watched that in full, but that's really the only one I've seen.
Yeah, no, I watched basically all of the first night, but yeah, I was there for AOC and that was pretty much it. I wasn't gonna waste my night on Colin Powell or something like that, which is just, he's a Republican. And how many possible votes could he swing? The current Republican Party, the Democrats have no idea what the Democratic Party should be, and they have no idea whatsoever about what the Republican Party is. They think it's the 80s or something.
Yeah, I have this, I'm sorry, we're going longer on this. I have this, I guess a hybrid approach on this, because I know Cenk and them were upset about the number of Republicans that are there. But this is a way to approach it. Now, if you had a viable party that was trying to be a big tent, which Tom Perez kind of said, he said, we're looking to unite, not divide more. This country's already divided enough. Great thing to say as the head of the DNC, cool. Now, if you actually want to embrace the liberal progressive message, bring in people like AOC, bring in other members of a new Congress, people that have come in and doing real things and are vocal and adamant about it. Mm-hmm. Bring those folks in, bring in your Colin Powells, bring in your John Kasichs, bring in all those guys that you think are gonna unify and bring in this moderate Republican vote. But you know what, as they're speaking there, there's gonna be this tone of progressivism and democratic values that are being put forward. So when you bring in these Republicans, they're gonna be signing on to real change and not gonna be just there as a face to bring in more Republicans. So Republicans, if you wanna come join, cool. But you're gonna have to understand what you're joining is something that's actually gonna help the American people differently than the way you used to do it, which was under the guise of just going through with normal political rhetoric, which is what the Republican Party's always done. Donald Trump came in and is doing the same things they like to do, just doesn't know how to say it the right way. Yeah, so these are the Republicans that have gone away from him are the ones like, well, he's a little bit too crazy and radical for me. Some of those policies he does I like, but not all of them. So let me go ahead and start going more to the left, but you're not going to the left. You're just going away from Trump.
Yeah. Yeah, look, we'll see. Some of them may be okay, like John Kasich, like just to forget, like Colin Powell, like the things he did. How can you forget the cost of the things he did? Anyway.
And,
you
know, and honestly, I'm kind of okay with Colin Powell because he did say, he's one of the few people who admitted, I did this and I did that.
That's
I was
true. Wrong.
I was the driver for that. I was used in this way. I not even like I was used and I'm too dumb to realize it. He goes, I was used and I should have known better. Like he had an actual reality based explanation for what he did.
True.
So
true.
that's the kind of acknowledgement we're looking for. When we talked about George Bush before, I think I was on with Anna and how he's painting pictures now. He's trying to rehab his image, but he's never pointing out what he did.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
The post office has engaged in any number of different manipulations of what is going to be necessary infrastructure-wise and procedure-wise, preparation-wise and finances-wise to get us ready to do the amount of mail-in voting that's going to be necessary for us to have a presidential election later on this year. And because of that, we've been doing a lot of coverage of it. There's been a lot of pushback against what Postmaster General DeJoy and the rest of the Trump administration has been doing vis-a-vis the post office. And now there's a little bit of a backpedal, but not really. With DeJoy saying on Tuesday that to avoid even the appearance of any impact on election mail, I am suspending these initiatives until after the election is concluded. Okay, so let's dive into these initiatives. He presents them as budget slashing policies, like limiting overtime, reducing the number of mail trucks, decommissioning sorting machines, all of which had the potential effect of slowing mail and deliveries of everything from packages to prescription drugs. It's been causing tons of problems to people already, let alone what's going to happen when the election comes. Mm-hmm. He says that those have been necessary because the Postal Service is financially unsustainable in the long term. And so all of these changes are designed to make the financial future of the post office brighter. Like changes like I saw from JR's story pitch email this morning, USPS quietly added rule prohibiting workers from signing mail-in ballots as witnesses. You know, to save money. What does that have to do with a dollar or a cent, let alone both? It has nothing to do with anything. It's designed to make it more difficult for you to vote. Absolutely. And if that means that a bunch of people don't get their prescription drugs in time, if that means that a bunch of people don't get overtime pay and their job becomes impossible, and people like veterans of the post office that have worked there for decades end up leaving because of what's happened, shouldn't have gotten in the way of a second term for Donald Trump.
That's all that matters. And a little bit more of details on that story about being able to sign off. So in Alaska, and when you have a mail-in ballot, you need to be a witness to sign it to basically validate it. And previous to this, postal workers could be that person. They could sign off you right there. It makes all kinds of sense in the world. You take your stuff in, there's someone there that signs it. They're no longer allowed to do that on the clock. They can still do it off the clock, because you may just run into a random postal worker when they're off the clock and ask them to sign your ballot information so you can have it sent off. No, that's voter suppression. That's making it harder for people to vote. We know that's 2 + 2 = 4. Number two, there's postal union heads across the country in different states. They were asked about this reversal by DeJoy. And what they've discovered is, and this is the first thing I thought, and I'm glad I found it immediately after this, is so what are they gonna do about all the problems they've already caused, number one? Number two, I don't trust them to now not do what they've been saying that they've been doing. Why would they change it? Or what is it that they're gonna do to try and basically cover up what they've been doing? So to quote a couple of people, Miriam Bell was the general president of local chapter of Postal Union in North Carolina. 7 sorting machines at that facility were separated out, dismantled, entirely removed in recent weeks. They asked her, are these gonna come back? And she goes, I don't know, they haven't told me anything. So the things they've already done are not coming back, or at least the people that would know about them coming back have no clue if they're coming back. This is not just the only time it's happening. It's happening in multiple locations where these sorting machines are dismantled, the inboxes are doing what they're doing with those, and those things are not being reversed. So as we see this continue, you may get more postal union workers talking about the fact that these things continue to happen, but will we pay attention, or will we just say, Louis DeJoy said he's not doing it anymore, so that's that, it's the end of that. No, they're gonna continue to do it, and they're not gonna reverse what they've already done.
Well, some might be, but you know who's not? The person who threw a wrench into the works at the DNC last night. Just kidding, AOC
Here's what she had to say about that announcement by DeJoy yesterday.
You know, Postmaster DeJoy can say whatever he wants about what changes will or will not happen in the future. He has lost the trust of the American people. He has lost our trust to make sure that he will follow through. After they said that they would suspend taking mailboxes out, there were reports and there was confusion about whether that was continuing to happen or not. We need to get him under oath on a committee letting us know what is happening, and we have to undo the damage that he has already done.
And how do you do it? How do you undo the damage that's already been done right now at the end of August when it's we have an election coming up, right?
Presumably legislation, but yeah, there's not much time.
Yeah, everything is red tape and paperwork. The way that politicians complain about the bureaucracy of DC, they know how it works. When they complain about it, they're the drivers of it. So every time there's planning and things put in place to make sure things go the way they want them to go. You think they don't know how this works? You think they don't know that they can't reverse all this and just undo everything in a matter of 2 months? No way, they know how this works. And so this is supposed to be a nice PR move before he goes in on Friday and gets dismantled about all the things he's been doing in front of the house. So before he goes in and does that, he's trying to arm himself with this declaration that he's reversing all of his previous decisions. Why are you reversing all your previous decisions if they were so awesome the first time?
Yeah.
I hope those questions get asked.
And so you say that sort of sarcastically, but realistically, why would he say he's stalling this if he hadn't already accomplished what he wanted to accomplish? Like, we know why he's doing this. It's not just that DeJoy wants the post office to shut down like permanently. He wants it to be hampered to help Donald Trump. Like, he's not worried about consequences. He's not gonna stop before he's done. He got what he needed. And maybe it won't be enough to save Trump. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe in 3 or 4 years, we'll get an Intel report about the manipulation of the election by the post office. And maybe some people will care. Even though this time around nobody does with the one we just got.
A couple of Democrats wanted a criminal investigation to go into this with DeJoy because of the things he potentially did that could be crossing into breaking the law. If you're doing that to hinder the Postal Service's delivery, or if you're doing it for personal gain, those things are illegal. So say you get pulled up on charge of that. Say that libs love it and go, oh man, Louis DeJoy's going to jail. Guess who can pardon him? You know? So there's no more fear of doing anything wrong or breaking the law for helping Donald Trump, because everyone who does that, as I think you want to mention, Paul Manafort, for it, you get pardoned for it. No matter how many laws you break, no matter how much you help international figures disrupt our electoral process, no matter how much you do that stuff, you can be off the hook. So you've got free range to do so. This law and order president is actually the opposite.
When Trump pardoned Roger Stone, it was pretty obvious from chapter one to chapter X of that whole story was pretty obvious to a lot of people. What he had done and why he didn't provide any information, why he intimidated witnesses while he was being investigated and all that and tried. And then he finally goes down and so Trump just lets him off because he wasn't a rat and he kept his secrets. But now in the bipartisan Intel report, we find out that indeed, he was contacting WikiLeaks, and when the Access Hollywood video came out, Trump and the campaign told Roger Stone, no, they have to release that stuff that they've got. And so he called them, and WikiLeaks released it within like an hour, 90 minutes, something like that.
Right.
And so he's been doing that from the beginning. He was investigated. He was found to have broken the law. He didn't provide any information, and he was pardoned. And that's why, like, when you look at the whole thing, it's in its entirety, like. Sometimes I get frustrated. I'm sure I've said it, but when people are like, if Trump wins re-election, like democracy will be done. No, it's not like it's an off or an on thing. Like, they've already done so much damage to accountability. Mm-hmm. Like, they got away with it. And we can like totally disagree about whether that was enough to have swung the election. Totally different story. They did it and got away with it. Hey, and it didn't matter what we found out. All of it's totally revealed now. Bipartisan Republican and Democratic Intel report. Doesn't matter. It does not matter.
Hey, so if you rob a bank and the bank still is in existence, does that mean it's a harmless crime? hey, you did some damage. You did some damage. There was accountable amounts of money that you took, and you broke the law, number one. And we shouldn't encourage this for future criminals. That's the basis for where we always talk about law and order. We have to penalize these people so that more people won't get inspired to do the same and know that they can get away with it. What is to keep people from thinking they can get away with this in the future if we don't actually do something about it? But no, when it comes to if you steal a pack of gum out of a 7-Eleven, the book is getting thrown at you because we cannot have little juveniles running in and stealing packs of gum that cost 25 cents. No, we can't do that.
Yeah, and I mean, like, we can't go into all of it about Manafort and everything, but like, you know, Trump, who, again, remember in the Mueller report, never actually testified. Isn't that crazy how it went on for years and he never had to actually go before him, and we know exactly why he didn't want to. In his written answer says, no, I don't recall ever talking to Roger Stone about WikiLeaks. And the report's like, no, he did many, many times. So it was perjury, but it doesn't matter. He gets to commit perjury. He just gets to.
Straight up.
Yeah, and so that's why, look, do I disagree with the the thrust of if he wins re-election, it's going to be really bad. No, I say the same thing, and I agree. It's going to be far worse, but it is not good now. They have already been extremely successful in doing damage that we have been doing reports on every day for a couple of years now. And some of that might be locked in. We'll see. Hopefully, if Biden becomes president, he can reverse some of it. But we also know that in terms of power that's accrued to the executive doesn't tend to be given up by the next one, whether it's the same party or otherwise. So we're gonna see. The entire thing it's disgusting. Bad news for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The Trump administration earlier this week announced that it's finalized its plan to open it up for oil and gas development, a move that overturned six decades of protections for the largest remaining stretch of wilderness in the United States. And if you feel a bit of deja vu, it's because the attempts to block the oil and gas development of ANWR is a thing that has had to be redone over and over and over again. Because when it's, you know, like reasonable, progressive values, you never actually win. You just hold off, okay? You might win on a pipeline for a little bit, but they're gonna come back, okay? It's not that way on the right. When what they want is just lots of money and free tax breaks, once they get that money, they keep that money, you know? But anyway, no, they finalized that plan, and Trump was very excited about it. And yesterday on Fox and Friends, he was asked about it, and he responds, he doesn't seem to have any idea what's going on or what the timeline is, but here he is talking about that.
News story from the Wall Street Journal. They say the Trump administration plans to open up part of the pristine Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil drilling. What can you tell us about that?
Well, we're looking at different things. We may or may not do it. We did do ANWR, as you know. ANWR is a big deal that Ronald Reagan couldn't get done and nobody could get done. Everybody wanted it.
This says you're planning
everybody
to allow it.
Well, no, we are looking at it. When you say planning to allow, we are looking at different things in Alaska. I've been very good to Alaska, very good to Alaska, and we are looking at things in Alaska. I got them a highway that's going to be built that they've been after for 44 years. We will take a look at that. I am very pro-energy at the same time.
They finalized their plan to open it up. He says, well, you know, we're thinking about it, and as a separate thing, we did ANWR. So we're thinking about doing something that we just announced for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And on the other hand, we did ANWR, which he has no idea that he's talking about the same thing. And he thinks that they're already drilling in ANWR, which is the thing that they just announced this week they're gonna open up for. He has no idea what is going on in his own government or what letters stand for.
If it wasn't for the stupidity that just is is unleashed every time he speaks, he has tells also. We already know whenever he's lying, he has these little moments where he points out, like if he's relaying a conversation someone had with him, he'd be like, and then they said, Mr. President, and then they said, sir, all that. Those are all the prequels of lies. So This is another one. Says we're gonna think about it. Oh, we're talking about it. We may or may not do it. Well, we know if you may or may not do it, is that's for life. Every time he's like, I may or may not get up at my alarm time. Well, yeah, that's how it works. Either your alarm goes off and you get up, or your alarm goes off and you smash it and you stay asleep. We know it. We know you may or may not do something. That's every decision in life. So what's the what are you on my show for? Talking about what you may or may not do on something that your team said they're doing, or for something that you have no idea about. There's nothing that's been more on display about the way they use this guy and his stupidity and his popularity with a bunch of racists to promote what they want to do. And then they tell him later, oh yeah, Mr. Trump, this is going to help you. Don't worry, everyone's going to love you for this. And he'll say, okay, that works for me.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, and I may or may not understand it. Yeah, no, he just doesn't like. And the thing is, like, understand two things simultaneously. One, surface level, shallow, we get to laugh at him because he doesn't know what he's talking about. That's fun, right? That's like Schadenfreude or whatever, especially needed in 2020. The other side, though, is that they are going to be opening up Anwar for oil and gas development. And they might potentially sell those leases before Biden gets into office, even if Biden wins. So the joke is here, but the joke is also fundamentally on us, because the largest unspoiled stretch of wilderness left in America is going to become spoiled after a decades long fight to protect it. So understand both of those things can be true. Now, to be fair, I guess we've been very critical of Trump on the environment up to and including right now, and that will continue. But for one moment, let's allow him to make the case for why he is in fact a great environmental president. In this video, he provides some examples of why that's true.
Look at what we just signed with Cory Gardner and Steve Daines just 2 weeks ago. We signed the biggest, probably the biggest environmental bill. They said the biggest since Teddy Roosevelt, and it could be bigger when you add what I did for Utah. So I'm very much, you know, I hate to say it, in theory, I should go down as a great environmental president, because if you take a look at that, add that onto what we did. Also, if you look at, I opened up the mines, the iron ore mines. We have the best in the world. So I opened that.
Okay, so also, and for, so his example is, I'm allowing more mining. So aren't I a good environmental president? And I have no response to that, I suppose. Aren't I a great animal lover? No, maybe not. Maybe you're not, though.
So wait, you know what? Because that's what he's been getting away with his entire life. He says he's a successful businessman. Reality says he's not. He says that he's smart. The reality is that he's dumb. Everything, but the problem is every time he says these things, they stick. Russia had nothing to do with colluding and my connection to me in 2016. 100% the evidence shows that he did, but it doesn't matter. He said the opposite enough times that dumb people said, oh yeah, you know what? I think Trump is telling the truth this time, outside of the 27,000 other times that he didn't. But this time he does, and then the next time he will, even though this time he's lying. I mean, I can't blame him. Hey, just suck your entire life. Say you don't suck and be successful. That's an easy way to make it to the top. You don't have to do anything else. You don't even have to even act like you're working. Just say that you're working. Sit at your desk, and when the boss comes around and says, hey, Donald, why are your feet up on the table like that, chewing gum and blowing bubbles? Because I'm working. Get away. And then he goes, you're right, Donald, promotion. Like, that's how his life has been. So what would make him do anything different now?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, we can't keep, like, yes, what he is doing is stupid, but it also generally has worked. Not everything, he hasn't accomplished all of his goals. Let's acknowledge that. I hate absolutist positions. I always hate absolutist positions.
Yeah.
But anyway, but he has succeeded on many of these things, so we should acknowledge that. Someone in the comments said we should have Standing Rock like protests for Anwar, which I agree, that would be great. The bad side is it is even more inhospitable in terms of the climate, and more importantly, is 19 million acres. So the fight is over about 10% of that or less, but it is still a very large area to cover. So we'll see, maybe that will happen, but you never know. We've already talked about any number of different polls for this general election pitting Biden against Trump. Now we have one today, but understand this is a different sort of poll. Okay, generally polls go out there and they talk to people at random to find out who they're likely to support. They provide controls and things like that. The poll we have for today, though, is a comparison of the stance of the same set of people
from how they voted for or against Trump back in 2016 to what they plan to do today. This is a panel poll with continuity of people. So let's take a look at some of the change and continuity here. So for Trump voters in 2016, 88% of them still plan to vote for Trump, to give you an idea of how much damage everything he has done over the last few years has done to his base. It's hurt him by a couple points. So that's great. 9% plan to cross over and vote for Biden, and 4% plan to vote for some other candidate. So a very small change for those. Now, for the Clinton voters, 92% plan to vote for Biden, 4% are turning to Trump, madness. And 4% there are like, I'm gonna go for a third party candidate or some other candidate. Now, perhaps most interestingly is what has happened to people who voted for a third party candidate back in 2016. Now, really fast, let's jump out of this graphic for 1 second, because I wanna make something very clear before we break down these numbers. When we talk about these third party 2016 voters, who do you immediately think that they are? You immediately think that they're Green Party voters, right?
Yeah, no,
that's not really the case. Though some of them are, yes, but I wanna make clear that we are not just talking about Green Party voters, because one of the weird things coming out of the election is that people's perception of the vote totals is very different. So Jill Stein got 1.07% of the popular vote. That's about 1.5 million votes. That's a big chunk of votes. Gary Johnson got 3.28% of the vote. 4.5 million votes. So Gary Johnson got more than three times as many votes. And the others, these other third party candidates, is about half as big as Jill Stein. So understand that these are Green Party voters, but they are also like 80% non-Green Party voters that we're talking about. So just understand that. Some of these are libertarians or conservatives who didn't like Trump or whatever. So for them, 41% plan to go for Biden, 30% for Trump, 28%, I think that is, plan to still vote for a third party candidate. So they're pretty evenly split, but the advantage goes to Biden there, and a similar sort of split basically for people who didn't vote in 16, either because they weren't old enough to vote at that point, or they just chose not to vote or whatever. About the majority go to Biden. So I know there's a lot of information here. We can leave this graphic up for a bit, but JR, what do you make of this?
Like you said, I mean, pretty straightforward, self-explanatory, but or expected, because I mean the Trump vote being that high still, that's the base. Those are the only people that he thinks matter in the country. Because obviously, if he can't appeal to anyone else, he can't appeal to independent voters, he can't appeal to new voters, and he definitely can't appeal to generally people who voted for Hillary last time. So it's just of that graph, the 25% section of it is all that they really care about for good reason, but I don't know if it's gonna do much as far as changing anyone's approach. Because sometimes if you see a certain way people are voting, maybe it'll change the way you vote. So maybe other third party people or some other new voters or voters who sat out last time, I don't think this is anything that would sway them to change their minds about the way they go. And this specifically for the third party folks, it looks pretty the same as what you would expect for them to do. It'll be split pretty evenly.
Yeah, I mean, we're gonna have to see. Miss Callie in the chat says the what's a Lepo guy got more votes than Jill Stein. Yeah, but I mean, look, there's always been a significant number of Libertarian, Reform Party, third party candidates. Like, we don't generally talk about that for some reason, but the right always has their third parties that get a significant amount of support. And in this particular case, Trump was obviously a very divisive candidate. So some conservatives didn't want to support Trump, but still want to vote for a right winger. So they went for Gary Johnson. That's why Gary Johnson did pretty well. I just think it's weird that nobody like remembers that that even happened. But in terms of how much third party support you can expect this time around, if this poll is accurate, then it looks like the majority of the third party support is probably going to go once again to one of the two main parties. And I would say, just spitballing it, looks like you'll probably end up with about 2%, give or take 0.5% of the popular vote going to a third party candidate, at least based off of this one poll. Who knows? But that sort of tacks with what I would expect based on the experience of the last few years. This election is gonna seem very real to people in a way that for some, about 1 in 20, it seemed very hypothetical in 2016. There's still gonna be third party support. There will always be third party support. But I do think that this race is gonna be a little bit different than others. But to get back to the main takeaways, the idea that Trump has lost only a few percentage points after everything. But then when you really think about it, why would he?
He said stupid stuff, but he said stupid stuff during the election. They like the stupid stuff. He said racist stuff. They want more racist stuff. Like, yeah, he's failed on a few things. You know, he didn't totally kill the ACA, although that in the end might actually have ended up hurting him. They think that they want that, but do they really? That's an open question. He got his tax cuts. He doesn't really have the wall, but they think that he has the wall. So Puerto Rico was devastated. They think good. I want it to be devastated. He brought us to the brink of war with Iran. They want war with Iran, and they don't think that coronavirus is real. So why would this have hurt him? Any of this, right? And by this I mean the last few years.
Yeah, it's worked for him almost, because you know he's answering the call of what they were hoping to see happen, which I'm not sure if they could have planned any of this insanity. But no matter what it is, it's the cult version of the support. It's no matter what he does, no matter what he says, no matter how much he's exposed himself as a fraud, they'll continue to be on board. Just because now what they can't do is undo their decision, because the hardest thing for Americans to do is to say, "Oh, my bad, I was wrong." Definitely yeah, that's true. Bad.
Well, that's why you pointed out that Colin Powell is like one of the few politicians that actually admitted that what he did was wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, nobody does that. Nobody. No. we had a presidential primary where you had Bernie Sanders, who was totally against the war in Iraq, and then you had some candidates who were very supportive of it that never had to even acknowledge that that was a massive mistake. Like these huge, as consequential a mistake as you could make, you just get to make in politics and media. Nothing ever hurts you.
If you change your mind in politics, you are a flip-flopper, you're a dino, you're a rhino.
Yeah.
And those are apparently things you cannot be, or else you should be run out of the country.
With the initial stimulus bill, the bailout of a number of different industries that passed, and those that are being debated right now, you might have been led to believe that that's designed to protect essential industries, you know, workers who have lost their jobs, you know, the downtrodden that need help. But there are some very tapped into politics organizations that have received help already and indeed are being targeted for more in bills that are forthcoming. And these are lobbying organizations, you know, the little guys. So we're being joined now once again by author and campaigns manager for Equal Citizens, Adam Eichen. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John. Always appreciate it.
Very excited to have you on today, in particular to talk about your most recent work, which is available now, talking about Congress and their bailouts of these lobbying groups. So tell me a little bit about some of the bills that are being considered right now, what makes them different, and how significant they'll be in terms of bailing out these types of organizations.
Right. And again, you know, you and I talked about this a couple months ago, and a lot has developed since then. You know, these groups are, you know, what we would call trade associations, but don't be, you know, don't think these are just innocuous groups, right? These are groups that represent a certain sector of business, and their entire purpose is to push the business perspective of a given sector in politics on the state level or in Washington, D.C. So, you know, these are lobbying groups, they're influence peddlers. They were left out of the payment protection program in the CARES Act, so they weren't able to access the PPP money. But now there's this big concerted effort among these groups to try and get a piece of the pie in the second round. And so again, these groups, you know, a lot of local chambers of commerce are considered trade organizations, but so are, you know, pharma and AHIP, the top one of the top lobbies for the healthcare industry. The Koch brothers, for example, the Koch network has a trade association, a 501c6 organization. And all of these organizations are trying to get a piece of that money that's supposed to be going to help small businesses continue to survive during this economic and public health crisis. And so it's patently absurd that Congress wants to give a handout to the largest of these, you know, trade association or what I would say lobbying groups. And so there are multiple bills floating around Congress right now, the most recent of which was introduced as part of the omnibus GOP bill, the HEALS Act. And this provision was introduced by Marco Rubio and Susan Collins. And it would give PPP eligibility to any 501c6 trade association, again, lobbying group, with 300 or fewer employees. Mm-hmm. Now, look, as I said the last time I was on this program, 99.8% of trade associations meet that threshold. So we're talking some of the biggest DC influence peddlers in the country. Now, the Rubio Collins bill does limit eligibility to groups that spend 10% or less of their time and receipts on lobbying. So that would actually cut off some of the worst groups. But here's the thing. The Association, or sorry, the American Society of Association Executives, which, and I kid you not, is a lobbying group for lobbying groups, is pushing to remove that provision. So, because it's too onerous. How will you know, they say, if a group spends more than 10% of its time on lobbying? And actually, there's a really interesting story here, because the Rubio Collins bill, we saw what we thought was the bill as introduced, and it was actually not terrible. It limited eligibility to, I think, 50 or fewer for 501c6 groups, not including chambers of commerce. So it was a really low threshold, and it limited the payouts, the loans, to $500,000 per group. And we thought that was the bill that was introduced. But little did we know that this group, ASAE, was lobbying behind the scenes. And in a couple hours after that draft was leaked, they completely rewrote the bill and raised it to 300 employee threshold, which again would basically include virtually all these groups, and got rid of the $500,000 loan max. So the fact that ASAE is trying to get rid of another one of these protections, gives me a sense that they could really do it, because they already did it once. Now, as a quick caveat, Rubio is apparently considering introducing an amendment to the bill that would restrict it to 150 employees and a couple other restrictions. So there's this give and take, because I don't think any politician really wants to go on the record bailing out these massive DC influence peddlers.
Yeah, but you would hope.
But the thing is that this is not an isolated instance. I mean, there's a standalone bill in the House, H.R. 6697, which is endorsed or co-sponsored by very prominent Democrats, including Representative Joe Kennedy, Carolyn Maloney, others. And then, of course, in the HEROES Act, the Democratic Omnibus Relief Package that was introduced and passed back in May, there was a lobbying group bailout on steroids. It was a massive giveaway that very few people reported on. I believe we talked about it last time. Essentially, it would create a special fund for any trade association that has 500 or fewer groups, which could include the Chamber of Commerce, which is basically public enemy number one for progressives. And I really want to underscore this point, John, is that these trade associations are the ones working every day in DC to block progressive change. So at least with the Republicans, I get they want to bail out their conservative buddies, on K Street. But I don't know what progressive Democrats are doing, or even center-left Democrats are doing, by trying to essentially give money to the people who are going to be fighting tooth and nail against any sort of progressive agenda that they'll be fighting for in 2021.
Well,
we do know. I know what you're going to say.
Yeah, if I'm going to be cynical, I'm going to say it is not a bad idea to shower organizations with money if you aim to be hired by those organizations when you stop trying to get elected into elected office.
There are definitely questions about revolving door. But look, if I'm being sincere, I am oftentimes very cynical. But I think that there's just so little information about that threshold, right? I think that a lot of progressives in Congress think this is a good bill because it's been framed as something that will help local chambers of commerce. But of course, it's not just bailing out local chambers of commerce. And so there is opportunity, I believe, for citizens to get engaged and get kind of angry about this. Because I think that if we can, this is one of the only benefits right now of the fact that the negotiations have completely broken down, is it gives us a little more opportunity to organize around a progressive bailout package. Now, I don't know if the Republicans will ever bend here. I mean, they're being totally cynical about things, if you want to say cynical, about trying to block funding for the USPS, for election administration, having a red line, or so they say, about liability protections for corporations. But there is an opportunity here, at least on this issue, to try and block it, because I don't think, as Marco Rubio showed, and maybe a little bit of an indication that he's willing to bend on this with the amendment, that no politician wants to come out in favor of bailing out lobbying groups. And because I have to say, John, my organization, the Democratic Policy Center, which I helped co-found, we did a poll with Data for Progress. And what we found is that the vast majority of Americans do not think it is important for Congress to bail out lobbying groups. Of course, we shouldn't have had to have a poll. We shouldn't have even had to conduct a poll because, of course, Americans don't want that.
Yeah.
But the caveat is what they do want. Almost 90% of Americans, our poll found, wants Congress to provide relief directly to families and individuals and to states and cities and small businesses, right? So there is a consensus in the American public that we should be aiming a relief package in a progressive fashion. Mm-hmm. And certainly should be excluding these groups that are designed in their core to influence public policy.
Yeah. So look, I totally agree with you. Philosophically, it doesn't seem like this is where our bailout money should be going. And by the way, I just want to comment that, and I'm glad that you stressed that 300 employee cap, which seems to be put in to imply that there's some sort of limitation when that's not actually a limitation anyway. I love that. It's such a disingenuous, condescending thing to add to a piece of legislation. But I also have a practical question, and I don't follow this 1% as much as you do, so perhaps you can help me to understand. So when I think about this bailout money and what it's intended to do, it's that there are industries, like for instance, restaurants, that don't have any customers right now. They literally can't employ their workers because there's no work to do, for instance, early on in the pandemic. They need money so that they don't permanently shut down. Okay, the restaurant's perhaps the clearest example of that, but there are many industries where they're making less money, they would have to furlough workers. And so we're trying to keep them alive until things can go back to normal. But that's where I don't understand practically what all of this is about, because these lobby organizations, the government is still functioning. They're clearly still lobbying. I mean, you said that lobby group that lobbies for other lobby groups is pushing for something, which I read as it's lobbying for something. Clearly, it's still able to do its job. So we have the philosophical reason why they shouldn't necessarily get this bailout. Practically, what do they need the money for if things are still proceeding from their point of view as they were before the pandemic?
Right, and I have an example of why it's so absurd in a second. But I think that what they would say is, well, they're struggling, right? So again, these are not lobbying firms in the sense that these are not groups that just employ lobbyists. This is much more subtle in terms of the influence. They have lobbyists, and indeed, almost all of these proposals ban the PPP money from covering any of the salaries or in some respects the actual lobbying activities. So the money can't cover it. The government money can't cover the lobbying stuff. So it could cover the staff, but the general staff, of course, that's kind of absurd in and of its own right, because you cover that staff, but that just opens up money for the lobbyists or for the ads or for the influence peddling, right? So that argument also doesn't hold. But I think you're right that they would say that they're struggling. And indeed, maybe they are, but this is why I draw a distinction about if we're going to extend it to these trade association groups, we certainly shouldn't be extending it to a group like pharma, which we know is funded by these pharmaceutical companies that are making tons of money right now, or the health insurance lobby, these lobbying groups, AHIP. We know that they're doing very well, even in this crisis. And in fact, this is my illustration. A group called the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, which is the kind of the dark money group that fought against Obamacare in 2009. They ran tons of ads against Medicare for All during the primary when Bernie was running. They just started running ads right now during the Democratic convention, attacking the public option plan that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden came to a consensus on. Mm-hmm. And so the fact that they're running millions of dollars of ads right now to try and block progressive change, and that group is partially funded by some of these trade associations, reveals the absurdity of this situation. That if they have enough money to be attacking progressive policy in the midst of a health crisis, then they deserve not a single cent of federal money, you would think.
So let me ask you, I know that we have several bills that are being considered, and the overall negotiations seem to have been stalled for quite a bit. And we know that the way that Trump talks about it, he says we can live with it, we can live without it. He's at least projecting that he doesn't believe that further stimulus is necessarily needed. When it comes to these particular sorts of priorities potentially fitting into the next round of stimulus, based on your research, what do you think is likely to happen? What do you think is likely to pass versus not pass?
I mean, I think something will eventually have to pass. I mean, I think that even Mitch McConnell has to concede this at some point. I think that they're really drawing a hard line, but I'm not sure how Congress can possibly not bail out Americans. I mean, this is, we're in the midst of a historic crisis right here. And so when it's all said and done, at least as it concerns this the bailout for lobbying groups, I think there's a real possibility that it does pass. I think there's a real possibility that there's some sort of provision to extend the PPP program to 501c6 organizations. The question now, at least from my point of view, is what limitations can we get on that extension? Because again, I want to be very clear here. If they extend PPP eligibility, that 501c6 trade associations can apply for the PPP money, that's okay. But if we had a limit of, say, you can't spend more than 5% of your time lobbying federal and state government, or we capped the employee threshold at 50. In other words, there are many reasonable limitations that we can do to allow the groups that actually don't have a lot of money to get relief and exclude these, you know, massive DC lobbying groups. And, you know, Democratic Policy Center, we've gone through the numbers. And again, the vast majority of these groups have like 20 or fewer employees. I think it's 90% of them have 20 or fewer employees. The vast majority are not in the hundreds of millions of dollars annual revenue. And so basically, if we impose very reasonable caps about what kind of groups could get this money under the umbrella of trade associations, that's something that we could live with. But what we cannot live with is giving millions of dollars in relief money to groups that are then going to turn around and bite us again in 2021 when they start running disgusting ads against even a modest healthcare reform platform.
Or continue running ads even during the election to put pressure on whoever ends up being the next president. Yeah.
Right. No, exactly. And but that's how this the influence game works. I mean, this is how it works, and we shouldn't be funding our enemies in terms of winning progressive change. And so that's why it's so important that people raise a little bit of hell right now around this proposal. And I have to say, I just want to say thank you for having me on again, because, you know, virtually no one is covering this, John. And I get it. There's a lot going on. But even in the midst of the crisis is when we have to be the kind of the most avid watchdogs, because this is the opportunity during the crisis where, you know, the most sludge can go into D.C. Yeah. I mean, there was a recent report from Open Secrets that just details how many lobbyists were involved in the crafting of these omnibus bills. And if you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably for dinner.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't agree more. Thank you for providing the oversight that you have, and hopefully we'll continue to as we go through this. And as you make your finds, feel free, come back on the show. We'd love to have you on to talk about it.
Thanks, John. Always appreciate it.
By the way, everybody watching this, the most recent op-ed is available at the Inquirer. Search for Adam Eichen and you'll find it there. You'll get all the statistics and everything. Adam, thank you again.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adarola. I'll see you soon.